It was only natural that my ananas and ananites were igniting and awakening my most erotic thoughts, which resulted in my having an immediate erection. I made an awkward attempt to conceal my thoughts and physical dilemma before she could read my mind. I'd accepted the drama was out of my league completely. She'd been very firm about letting me know that she was not going to have any kind of sexual encounter with me. To my great surprise, she pulled me even closer. I wrapped my arms around her, putting my face against her neck, as we held each other in a loving embrace. I began stroking her hair, her back, kissing her soft skin, then, lifting her in my arms, I kissed her lips, her face, neck and shoulders, finally nestling my face in the cleavage of her breasts. I was about to say something, when she put her fingers over my lips. I heard her voice inside my head saying, "Don't spoil this beautiful moment with words." She brought her face close to my ear. I thought she was going to whisper something, but she began biting gently on my ear. Erotic euphoria spread over me. We began to breathe and pulsate together as if we were one being. I lost all sense of separateness. She became me, I became her. I even lost consciousness of who was who at that very moment as I alternated between feeling I was a male then feeling I was a female. We hardly moved. It was as if the energy we were creating became its own being, rhythmically breathing, feeling, pulsating. I lost all sense of time and space and let myself flow into an unknown universe of vibrating energy. I don't remember how long we stayed like that, wrapped around each other in the water. We were silent for a long time before I got out of the water to light another candle. I was satisfied, relaxed. We stayed in the water, peaceful and contented, for an hour or so before returning to the hotel to get a bowl of hot soup to warm ourselves. By 3 in the morning, Rama and I were back in my room, in bed. We had been snuggling together for several moments, when I heard Rama's voice in my mind. By this time, that also seemed perfectly natural to me. She said, "Wasn't that a beautiful feeling? I've never felt anything so powerful as what I've just experienced," I answered. "Is it because you're from another world? Why does being close to you affect me that way?" "My being from another world has nothing at all to do with it," she said. "What happened during our intimacy was that energy rays were being transmitted between us while we were touching and rubbing against each other. You became part of my spirit, you absorbed some of my ananas and ananites, and I absorbed yours. Spirit is contagious like that." We had a long mind-to-mind conversation, exchanging both words and mental images before falling asleep wrapped in each other's arms. Chapter 8. The Education of a Non-Believer. I awakened on Sunday with Rama nestled against my hairy chest. Lying there, contently holding her in my arms, I replayed in my mind our lovemaking scene in the water the night before. Rama had said we were exchanging vibrations, becoming part of each other. I recalled hearing about clinics in New York and California where people make each other well by embracing. Passing ananas and ananites, Rama would have said. Even though I felt close to her, and had come to accept that she was some form of advanced intelligence, I still had my doubts about the things she was telling me and the astral travel she was proposing. Not to mention the book she wanted me to write. It was like two possibilities, the biggest fool in the world or the greatest hero. And I wouldn't know which it would be until it was too late. Rama had said her mission was to save the world and humanity. And nothing I'd observed about her so far could disprove her sincerity. She was always peaceful, precise and firm. I kept telling myself I had no reason to fear her, just because she was supposed to be from another planet. I wasn't being held hostage. I knew I could leave any time I wanted to. I also felt I'd be a fool to leave now. Just then, Rama woke up and began moving her body against me contentedly. We made love again. I found the experience had nothing to do with being in the water. It was our at one vibration and yet somehow completely free. Afterwards, she jumped out of bed and began playfully throwing my clothes to me, so I could get dressed while still under the covers in the cold room. 127 we decided that since it was Sunday, we would go to the fair in Huangqiao. Being with her now seemed so familiar, as if we had been married for 25 years. We got into my car and headed toward Huangqiao. My head was still euphoric, even though I didn't quite understand what had happened between us. It is about an hour's drive to the fair. I looked at Rama tenderly, and tried to tell her what a wonderful experience loving her had been. As usual, Rama began analyzing what had happened, calling it a spiritual resuscitation. "Let's make it easier," she said. "When someone masters the control of the third force, that person's aura or spirit moves at a consistently even frequency. Remember the other day when you saw that shining gold around me? All I have to do to make that happen is relax, concentrate, find that inner peace. If you want to be religious, you could say I was in a state of grace, like the saints." At that moment, my spirit was illuminated by Ananas and Anionites. Not in my body, but in its surroundings, in space, in the cosmos. My state of grace attracted the forces of the universe. While we were close, a part of my spirit went into you. My Ananas and Anionites merged with yours so that now you can sense in your own soul that even frequency. You mean I'm prepared to astral travel now? Yes, Charles. How did that happen? You just took a crash course. The long period of preparation necessary under normal circumstances was accelerated by this direct spirit-to-spirit resuscitation. Before that, you couldn't have done it by yourself, with all your fears and doubts and paranoias. So I've absorbed a piece of your spirit, huh? Yes, you could say I've given you a blessing, she said, and I want you to remember something. Exodus, chapter 34, verses 29 through 35. The passage that tells about Moses coming down the mountain after seeing Jehovah. His face shone so brightly he had to cover it with a veil. Maybe Moses had a little affair, too? Maybe. Remember, Moses was chosen by Jehovah because he already had a solid foundation in the knowledge of the God concept as the third force. Only Moses, his brother Aaron, and a few other people were allowed to go up into the mountains in those days. It was better for the cosmonauts not to mingle with big crowds. Also, Moses was the only one who could talk to Jehovah. Where and how did Moses learn such things? All I know is that he was born of slaves, taken out of the Nile River by an Egyptian princess, and raised by nobility. 30 years of his life is omitted by the Bible, except that he was educated by Egyptians who must have had some knowledge of this third force, since they were so advanced. Moses learned at the same place where all the greatest men of your world have gone for learning. Even Jesus the Christ studied there. Where's that? The Great Pyramid. The Rosicrucians claim the Great Pyramid as a source of wisdom in their beliefs. The Rosicrucians are a group of people who cultivated their spirit with metaphysical methods rather than through religious teachings. The important point is that what happened to Moses is happening here. I want to make this concept clear. You can pass on to others your chemistry, your soul, your vibes. Jehovah or one of his cosmonaut staff passed it on to Moses in some way or another. I've done it with you by being intimate. You're a strong character. You displace a great deal of energy in the cosmos. Each individual displaces a certain amount of energy, some more than others, depending on the individual's makeup. A loud, excitable person's nervous system vibrates constantly, displacing energy into space. You could compare this to burning calories. All emotions, anguish, jealousy, fear, pleasure, have their energy displacing devices. Peace, love, joy, are vibrations. Anger and pain use a different frequency level. When you say a person displaces energy, do you mean we generate it with our bodies? Yes. That force around you, the aura, is absorbed from the cosmos. Let me give you an example of how this force operates on a practical level. Let's say one day you're on a street and there's an automobile accident. A child gets trapped under the wheels of a car. As soon as the mother sees the situation, she runs to the rescue and picks up the front end of the car, freeing the kid. Many times, under certain circumstances, you gain extraordinary strength and energy, giving you the ability to do things you normally couldn't do. In this case, the desperate mother lifts 150 times her own weight, which is mathematically and seemingly physically impossible. The chemical responses in her body changes, her heart beats faster, her lungs pump lots of oxygen, her whole nervous system generates tremendous amounts of electric shock throughout her entire body. At this given moment, she's a mass of energy. Then she runs, picks up the front of the car, and pulls the child to safety. If she had to do the same thing under normal conditions, she couldn't possibly do it. "I know exactly what you mean," I said, remembering that something like that happened to me when I was in college. "Tell me about it, and we'll analyze it." I was involved in a lot of Vietnam peace demonstrations then. They weren't unusual, it was happening in colleges all over the United States and was typical of my generation. I'd been arrested several times while taking part in these demonstrations. On this particular day, as I left my mother's house, she warned me very sternly that if she had to bail me out of jail once more, I would be facing a lot of trouble. I assured her it would only be a peaceful demonstration and that there was nothing to worry about. As it turned out, the only peaceful thing about this demonstration was the name. As usual, things got out of hand. Before long, we were surrounded by policemen with tear gas, arresting people. The only escape route, the alley, was blocked by two police cars. I guess I feared my mother's wrath more than the police. I don't know how I got the strength to jump over the trunk of one of those police cars, but I did. "That's simple, Charles," Rama said, smiling. "Faith. You knew you could do it because you had to. Like the mother who lifts the car, you knew you could perform that miracle. At that split second, your leg muscles reacted in such a way that your whole nervous system, your thinking processes, and all of your body movements were part of a cosmic force outside of your body. That force gave your legs the strength and spring that enabled you to jump over that car. There is a passage somewhere in the Jewish Talmud that says a lesson learned with pleasure is a lesson remembered. If this were true, I knew I would probably remember everything Rama ever said to me." As she talked, she smiled, touching me frequently, her animated face communicating her tender feelings for me. I said, "Rama, when you mentioned I would be able to take my spirit out of my body, I was excited. But today, as I think about it, I'm still a little edgy about this whole thing. Would you please be more specific as to why we are doing this?" She quickly responded, "I'm doing it because I want you to understand your own spirit, and to be able to take it out of your body. You'll discover it has many benefits. It's an adaptation device which will make you more receptive, more aware. Then you'll be able to learn more quickly and grasp the concepts I will be teaching you. You'll be able to assimilate more information and make deductions faster and more accurately. Also, you will develop the ability to read the minds of people around you, so that you know their intentions. You'll be able to develop your memory to a degree you never thought possible. Once you learn to astral project, to take your spirit out of your body, you and I will be able to stay in touch with each other telepathically. You'll see, it's going to be fun. You'll also be able to know you've found eternal life. Once you've developed these skills, acquiring this new gift, you'll be tempted to show the world. You'll want to share your knowledge with others. It's natural to have this reaction. But how can this happen? By mixing our spirits, our ananas and ananites, we have become one massive spirit. Do you remember in the Prophet, where Kahil Gibran writes, 'He was she and she was he, they were one.' That's what we did. We merged our spirits into one mass of energy. You experienced new things. From this point on, whatever took you normally, let's say, 5 days to learn, you'll be able to learn in a day and a half now. Why are you doing this for me? Not that I'm being unappreciative, but why is it so important that I leave my body? because of what I told you about the destruction coming to your planet. Millions of people are going to die. By taking your spirit out of your body, you'll be experiencing something similar to death. The difference is your body will stay in one place and your spirit will be out in the cosmos. You'll be able to return any time you want to. Death will have no power over you. This is sort of preparation for physical death. It's something your churches should have been preparing you for. You're telling me astral travel will be sort of like dying? Yes, that's what I'm saying. Oh, boy, then I'm definitely taking a rain check on this. I have no desire to fool around with these kinds of things. Come on, Chicho, there's nothing to be afraid of. Lots of people do it. I can't think of any reason why you shouldn't. It's the same as being asleep. When you return to your body, you'll have a dreamlike effect, but you'll also have 100% understanding and conscious recall of what went on when your Ananas and Ananites were out of your body. I understand the concept, I just don't feel ready for it, somehow. I'm not sure I want to do it. Don't worry about it. I'll be with you, helping you. It's something like going into a self-trance. You must be totally relaxed and at peace with yourself. Rama, I insisted. Still don't understand why it's so blasted important to have my soul leave my body. Well, first of all, it'll save us lots of time. Instead of doing research and digging into encyclopedias, you'll be learning things while your body rests peacefully somewhere. In other words, if you want to learn about, let's say the bees, ants, or just about anything, the only thing you will have to do is to take your spirit out of your body and go wherever your place of learning is. Let me give you an example. Say you wanted to learn about intimacy in the life of bees, you'd take your spirit out of your body and go inside a beehive. You'd get much greater benefit from being there as an eyewitness, seeing how the bees work, than by reading about them. You would see, experience and even sense everything with your five senses as if you were actually a bee. Once you returned to your body, your memory cells would have assimilated whatever you had learned by being inside the beehive. You're saying this energy, this soul of mine, would be as small as a bee? How could I be in a beehive and yet have my body sleeping somewhere else? You take your spirit for an outing and you see a bee flying nearby. Then you transport your ananas so that you have another body. Ears, eyes, and all the senses. What happens to the bee? She lends her ananites to your spirit. Together, your ananas and her ananites make one mass of spirit, one whole awareness. Your spirit has to absorb some of the sensations of the bee. It will be as though you yourself are a bee. You've heard about possession, right? Haven't you worked on several movies dealing with the subject of diabolical possession? When you astral travel, the phenomenon is similar. Your spirit is very elastic, it can be as big as the universe or as small as one of the units we have discussed before. So possessing the mind of a bee wouldn't be too difficult. You can possess the mind of a bird, a fish, a dog, a horse, anything you wish, just as long as you have some living creature with sensing devices. When I astral travel, must I always possess the mind of a living creature in order to have full consciousness of what's going on? No, not always. When you project both ananas and ananites together, your spirit will take human form at a distance, without a body. That would be your ghost or your phantom. At that time you'll have full awareness and the ability to feel, touch, smell and hear the surroundings of that mass of energy. There will be no need of possessing any living creature then. Your spirit will take human form at a distance without a body. Does this clarify it for you? It's still confusing. We're going to have to get this very, very clear. Don't worry, don't worry. I plan to convey this concept clearly before we do anything. When will we do it? We're going to do it today. Maybe this afternoon when we come back from the fair. And when we start doing it, I'll be giving you exact directions. We drove for a while in silence while I pondered the things Rama was saying. I thought about what it would be like traveling around in the body of a bird or traveling to the farthest planets in outer space. Rama, I want to ask you something, I said. You mentioned life on the sun. The sun is a world like any other, except that it's very big. There's no fire on its surface, no more than on the Earth or any other planet. In fact, even less, because it's a very old world and its cooling process is greater. The humanity living on the sun is similar to man on Earth. The only difference is people's weight and height, they're lighter and taller. They're also more advanced in knowledge than new people on Earth, or even than the people in my world. It may take you thousands of terrestrial years to fully learn what an average sun inhabitant knows about God as a third force. Where do they get their light from? The sun has its own self-ignited light, reflected by the light of the spirits. And it attracts its light from the other solar systems. What about the fire we see here? We sense heat from the sun, we see the light, and we can observe the sun in a color scope. We see flames. Where does all this come from? Imagine a huge magnifying glass in the universe. This magnifying glass is an atmospheric layer between the sun and the planets. It works something like this: the sun emits energy rays, and when they hit this atmospheric layer, they ignite into fire and light. At a given point in the universe, there is a cosmic layer between the planets and the sun. I'm going to draw it for you, because I don't want you to have any misconceptions about this. Mars, Jupiter, Earth. She used the pad of paper I kept handy whenever we were together to draw a picture of the sun's energy system. You're saying, then, that the sun is a planet as cold as the Earth, and that there's no fire on the surface? Right. Remember, there are many religions whose source of life and religious inspiration is the sun. The Incas, the Egyptians, Mayans, Aztecs, and many others have said that they were direct descendants of the sun. I studied that. Okay. When you study the ancient Peruvians' history, you'll read about Manco Capac. He's the man who is said to have founded the Inca Empire. He came out of Lake Titicaca and founded the city of Cuzco because his father, the sun, sent him to populate the earth. He said he was the son of the sun day when the ancient Peruvians saw the Ufonauts coming in their flying saucers, clothed in the same color as the sun, with rays of fire. They thought these UFOs were actual sparks from the sun, and the people emerging from the spaceships were called sons of the sun day. When I was studying Peruvian history, I theorized that they called themselves the sons of the sun because they either claimed to have come from the stars or related to the stars in some way, I said. This makes a lot of sense after seeing the Nazca Plains, Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman, the Gate of the Sun at Tiahuanaco, and all the other unexplainable things I've seen. I think it's very possible the ancient Peruvians had contact with outer space people. Is it true? Yes, Chicho, they did. The same way Moses talked to Jehovah and Ezekiel talked to his Ufonauts. Here they call them Wiracocapacacamac, and Tarqui, and a few other names we'll be revising as we go along. I recognize those names. These people were divinities that came from heaven. Many times they took human form. When you do your research, there's a man, W. Raymond Drake, who's written some very interesting books on this subject. Gods and Spacemen in the Ancient West is one. He gives lots of details dealing with the ancient Peruvian traditions and their ways of being in contact with the stars. Once you've read it, I'm sure you'll have no further doubts. Especially about our activities. Have you ever spoken to this man? No. But his work is quite explicit and simple, like von Daniken's. You know, when it comes to writing a book, I really don't know whether or not I could handle it. Don't worry about it now, kiddo. We're going to go to the fair, buy a few things, get some food, and when we get back, we'll go to the medicinal waters, have a picnic, and cook our food outdoors. In other words, just have fun. Chapter 9, The Education of a Non-Believer, The Final Phase. We arrived in Huancayo shortly before noon. It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining. As usual for a Sunday, the town was filled with people. Rama and I went from one end of the fair to the other, taking about an hour to walk 5 city blocks. Again, I was amazed by the vitality of the city on Sundays. We explored as many places as we could find, looking at antiques, jewelry, artwork, clothing, shoes, food, auto parts, vegetables, livestock, you name it. There was something for everyone. Let's buy some food and a pot so we can cook outdoors when we get back, Rama suggested. This is something you must start learning now, because in a few years, when your world is stricken by famine, you should be able to grow your own vegetables. It'll give you a better chance for survival. Learning to do these little things now, how to cook outdoors, to balance your diet, what makes your body function better, is a good place to start. When you take care of your body, you're taking care of your spirit. I guess you're right, I said. Lots of religions tell you how to diet, what to eat, what not to eat. When you diet properly, your body functions better. It depends on how you eat, how you sleep. The kinds of food you eat organize the molecules of your atoms, which range and structure themselves into your physical body. When you eat grains, like corn, wheat, barley, the molecules of these grains rearrange in your system and distribute your atoms evenly. Your whole physical constitution begins to organize after the pattern of the molecules in the grains you eat. How does that help the human body? 139. Your bone structure becomes stronger, your fibers are stronger, your whole nervous system works at an even pace, making you less excitable. If you eat carrots and lettuce, you help your optical nerves. If you eat beets, you improve your kidney function. When you drink milk, your digestive system is aided by coating the walls of your stomach. I've heard of macrobiotics and homeopathic remedies, they use the same principles. As we walked along, talking, a woman approached us with what looked like a Chinese wok, handmade from copper and very pretty. Without saying a word to each other, I knew Rama wanted me to buy it. I gave the woman some Peruvian currency and we continued on our way with our new copper wok. After a while we stopped by a few produce markets, picking out vegetables and fish, exploring the fair as we did our shopping. I enjoyed the sight of so many thousands of people from all over the world in one small remote mountain area. The tourists were Oriental, American and European, as well as native South Americans. The Sunday fair in Huancayo, Peru, is very famous. Rama and I were like any other young couple. She looked like an ordinary American hippie tourist, certainly not like someone from another planet or civilization. We walked together, sometimes holding hands, kidding each other, pulling each other along, and laughing a lot. I liked being out in public with her. It struck me that her behavior was very ordinary, like any other human being on this earth. She was completely relaxed and content, yet it seemed she used every minute I spent with her to teach me something new and exciting. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we both decided it was time to get back. I began to feel a little anxiety again, because I knew when we got back to Acaya I had to make a decision, one that could change my life completely. There I was, scared out of my wits. But I'd given her my word that I would try it, and try it I would. It was an hour's drive back to Acaya, and as usual, Rama used the time for instruction. She had been right when she'd said I would begin to look forward to our mind-bending conversations. This time, she started preparing me for my first out-of-body trip. She began by explaining that light, which is the origin of life, is also the reason there is life on the Sunday in this case, she said. Light is not color, but an electrical frequency linking the physical body and the spirit. For the purpose of taking my spirit out of my body, she asked me to think of the light that connects the body to the soul as the silver cord. She emphasized the importance of finding this silver cord. This is the first step, she said. To find the silver cord in the light you have to be at peace, you have to be vibrating at the right frequency. To find it, you look straight into a point of light. It could be the light of a candle, the reflection of some object reflecting sunlight, a sunset, a light in the distance, any light will do. Once the brightest point has been found, you go into a semi-trance, seeing this light coming directly into your eye. By squinting your eyes, you can make it larger, thinner, or stronger.